Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
The Harper government's anti-terror legislation is front and center this week as debate begins in the House of Commons. As more concerns about the legislation come to light, the opposition NDP says it will use every tool available to fight it. We speak with New Democrat public safety critic Randall Garrison.
And with a new poll showing 7 out of 10 Canadians want to see more oversight for our spy agencies, McLean's panel discusses whether or not it's possible the government will be forced to make amendments.
This week's cover story of McLean's magazine argues German Chancellor Angela Merkel is the new leader of the free world and the only person who can stop Russia in its conflict with Ukraine. McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes sits down with foreign correspondent Michael Petru to discuss his profile of the European leader.
We also speak with the Parliamentary Budget Officer about his conflict with the Defense Department over the cost of the mission in Iraq. And we'll let you know how a pair of underwear caused a disruption and a lot of laughter in the House of Commons.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. This week, the Harper government's new anti-terror legislation reached the floor of the House of Commons for debate. Just before that happened on Wednesday, NDP leader Thomas Mulcair announced his party's position on the bill, and it may not be a surprise. In a scathing announcement, Mulcair says his party will oppose it.
Stephen Harper's new law is sweeping, dangerous, vague, and ineffective. It doesn't do things that are proven to work and puts politics ahead of protecting Canadians. Even when he introduced the legislation, Mr. Harper chose a campaign-style event and made remarks that, most regrettably, targeted Muslim communities. There's not leadership there that unites Canadians. C-51 introduces a sweeping new mandate for CSIS to disrupt threats. Yet the Conservatives refuse to answer what activities this new mandate would indeed allow. Experts warn that broad measures in this bill could lump legal dissent together with terrorism. And the bill would give significant new powers to CSIS without addressing serious deficiencies in oversight. The bill also comes on the heels of cuts to our security agencies, cuts that sideline other public safety priorities.
Mulcair argues the bill's language is so vague it could be used to spy on the government's political opponents, such as protesters. But Public Safety Minister Stephen Blaney is dismissing these arguments and the NDP's stance. In a scrum before going into the House, Blaney defended the legislation, discussed possible amendments, and took shots at the opposition.
Regarding the bill, I am disappointed to see that the NDP will oppose our common sense approach on tackling terrorists and adapting our measures and our government's response to this evolving threat. Now, regarding potential amendments, it will be up to the committee to decide if it can be bonified in any way.
The NDP says the bill is too broad, that it could catch lawful protesters, and that the CSIS powers to disrupt so-called plots are too powerful. They're saying they're going to stop the bill at any means necessary if you don't change it. Are you open to changing some of the definitions or tightening the bill in any way?
Well, once again, if the NDP would read the third three-page of that bill, they would see that there is a specific exemption of all lawful advocacy, protest, and all sorts of activity. So once again, the NDP are demonstrating they are taking an ideological stand. It's no surprise. For years here in Ottawa, they have always opposed our anti-terrorism measure. It's disappointing, but somewhat not surprising.
The McLean's panel will discuss this issue in minutes, but first we will speak with a New Democrat about why they are opposing this bill and what they hope to change in the legislation. Joining me by phone is NDP public safety critic Randall Garrison. Could you explain, I guess, I know it's a hard bill to summarize, there's a lot going on here, but are there sort of the main complaints, the main concerns you have about this legislation?
Well, for me, the anti-terror bill, at the same time as it addresses a real concern, which is terror threats, exhibits the Conservative government's tendency to overreach. And it goes too far in terms of its impacts on civil liberties of all Canadians. And at the same time, probably isn't going to be effective against the real threats that we face.
How do you mean you don't think it'll be effective?
Well, as many people have often characterized it, looking for terrorists is like looking for a needle in the haystack. And what the government does by casting too broad a net stacks up more hay and makes it more difficult. So in collecting information on way too many people, your resources get wasted and you actually may miss the real threats to our security.
In terms of the overreach, is it giving CSIS a new mandate that concerns you most? Is it the information sharing within government? You know, what are the kind of main points you think where they've gone over gone further than they need to go?
Well, certainly information sharing, and when the government gives examples of what would be allowed, they talk about information sharing about terrorist threats. But what's actually in the bill is much, much broader than that, and it talks about threats to the security of Canada, threats to the stability of another country. It's got a very, very long list of things that are drawn, as I said, into the net, whereas I think if we were talking about a bill that made some improvements on information sharing specifically about terrorism, probably no one would have a problem with that. But they've gone way beyond terrorism and what they've included in information sharing, and in doing so, they've torn down one of the basic principles of privacy rights in Canada, which is that information should only be used for the purposes for which it was collected and not for whatever purposes government departments think might be useful to them.
To go back to sort of the premise here, do you believe that there needed to be changes or there needs to be changes given the situation as it is now, given where the legislation is now? You know, the emergence of ISIL, the sort of, you know, when people talk about the threat evolving, does the NDP believe that there needs to be some kind of bill here now?
Well, we've always said if there are gaps, we're quite prepared to look at what needs to be done to fill those gaps. But the very fact that the police have been able to make arrests in terrorism cases across the country leads me to believe that there's not a generalized problem in dealing with these threats, other than, as we pointed out repeatedly, the government has cut resources for the RCMP, for CSIS, Canadian Border Services Agency, consistently each and every year since 2012. And that's resulted in the RCMP commissioner appearing before a parliamentary committee saying he had to transfer resources from organized crime fighting and drug fighting because he didn't have enough resources in national security. And the operations director of CSIS saying before a parliamentary committee that they didn't have enough resources to monitor everybody they put on their threat list.
How is there anything going forward that could save this bill for you that would get the NDP support?
Well, I think when you see a government that can't even wait 24 hours before they limit debate, it doesn't bode well for any openness of the government to take a serious look at what's in their own legislation.
Do you see a way to propose amendments that would address, you know, some significant number of your concerns that could get this bill to a point where the NDP would support it?
Well, we'll do everything we can, but I have to point out that when we dealt with the last CSIS bill, we were given about a minute and a half to look at each amendment that had been proposed. So it was very clear that the government used its majority, so there was no real debate about amendments in committee. So I'm very skeptical that we'll see anything different at this time.
In terms of oversight, this has become one of the more prominent issues. Do you have a preference on whether that's increasing the mandate and the resources for CSIRC, whether that's bringing in a parliamentary committee? Is it just that we need more oversight, or do you see a specific issue? Like, do you see a specific option that you like more than the other?
Well, I think it's in essence both. We've had calls for increased oversight stretching back more than a decade now, and in fact, when the Liberals were government in 2004, we had an all-party agreement to increase the oversight, and the Liberals failed to get that done before their government was defeated in the House. And when we look at the operations specifically of CSIRC, if you look at their own annual report last year, they have said that they had problems monitoring CSIS because CSIS wasn't fully honest with them, and that's before we've added to this vast new increase in responsibilities. And I think one of my particular concerns is the government tries to fend off the oversight issue around CSIS by saying, well, judges will provide oversight. And I think that's disingenuous on their part at best. Because when they say that these new disruption activities require a warrant, that's not true. They only require a warrant if CSIS believes the activities they would undertake might violate the law or people's rights. And CSIS doesn't have a very good record when it's gone to courts before asking for warrants, and we know that from the Mosley decision, where the federal court said they weren't completely honest, and after they had the warrant, they didn't do what they said they were going to do with the warrant. And so the conservatives say, well, judges will provide oversight of the warrant. They don't. Once they've granted the warrant, CCC is able to go away and do whatever it will under that warrant. And so the difference here is when police request a warrant, then the information that's collected on that warrant ends up in a court case, ends up in a prosecution, where judges do have the ability to supervise what happens with it. In CSIS disruption activities, these things will most likely never end up back in court again, and so there is no opportunity for the courts to provide that oversight, and that will fall to CERC, which has literally not enough resources to do the job it has now.
Do you think Parliament could provide that oversight? I mean, I guess one of the counter-arguments against the idea of a parliamentary committee is that, you know, this question of whether parliamentarians would take it seriously enough, the question of national security and swearing MPs to secrecy, whether they would just be co-opted essentially by the national security apparatus into sort of acquiescing to decisions. You know, can we have a legislative body that provides oversight of CSIS and does serious work?
Well, I don't really take those arguments seriously because all of our allies have managed to make this work. And so I'm not sure that Canada's democracy is so much weaker than the others that it couldn't stand having Parliament take a very serious role in the oversight of national security agencies.
Would you be, I mean, so in your mind, just to go back to this, in your mind it's a matter of increasing CERC's ability and setting up a legislative committee or a parliamentary committee?
I think those would both be necessary. And again, the other thing when you talk about, we're talking about CSIS oversight, is that it ignores the fact that many other aspects of our national security apparatus have no oversight at this time.
I should ask, is there anything you like about the bill?
Well, I have trouble getting beyond the very many major problems in the bill. I'd be at a loss right now to name something that looked very good.
That was NDP public safety critic Randall Garrison discussing the Harper government's anti-terror legislation.
While the bill was being argued in the House of Commons, Angus Reid issued a new poll showing 4 out of 5 Canadians support the government's legislation, but 69% of people surveyed added they also want to see increased oversight for our law enforcement and spy agencies. That seems like a vindication of the Liberal stance on the bill. Leader Justin Trudeau announced he would support these measures, but will be introducing amendments to try and get more checks and balances for the agencies, which will see their powers increased under these proposed laws.
It's now time for the Maclean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined as always by my co-host, Aaron Wary, the Associate Editor for Maclean's, and Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes. Thanks very much for joining us. Okay, so Bill C-51, the anti-terror legislation, was front and center this week, and we're talking specifically about amendments. The poll came out recently saying that most Canadians do agree with the principle of this legislation, but they do want to see oversight. I think it was 69% said they want more oversight for our spy agency and law enforcement officers. On top of that, we had this letter that was released by 18 prominent Canadians, former prime ministers, former solicitor generals, chief justices of the Supreme Court, calling for more oversight. So the pressure is building. John, do you think we're going to see any change at all coming from the government moving forward?
If I had to bet, you know, on a binary choice, they will change, they won't change, I guess I would say they won't change. They have a majority. They see this as a political winner for them. They probably push it through. But I'm not absolutely confident about that. And one reason is I wonder how they see the conservative-liberal NDP triangulation here right now. A cynical way to think about this would be as follows. The conservatives view Justin Trudeau and the liberals as their main opponents. Trudeau has put himself in the sort of middle ground on this. The NDP has established itself as the sort of most vigorous opposition to the bill. Could the Conservatives seem to be bending to some of the NDP demands and sort of seem to be sidelining the Liberals at the committee stage on this or something along those lines? That would be a very political way of playing it. In terms of the pure policy questions, I don't think the government is inclined to think there's anything wrong in the policy of this bill, no matter how loud the outcry against it becomes.
So I'll quibble with John just a bit. I think we're seeing a replay of the Fair Elections Act here, where expert opinion may line up against this bill, and you may have days, weeks of committee hearings in which you hear complaints about how this bill is structured. And at that point, I wonder whether public opinion starts to say that the government should bend a little on this. I think the oversight change is kind of a gimme. I don't
I don't quite understand the government's steadfast opposition to it. It seems like the sort of thing that you could accept and not necessarily have a problem with it down the road, that, you know, you're going to get blamed for it. You know, whether that's, increasing the mandate of CERC to actually provide oversight, whether that's establishing a parliamentary committee to provide oversight, that seems like the easiest change to make. And I, to a certain degree, I wonder whether the government is sort of keeping that around as a compromise that they can make.
And to Aaron's point, I have spoken with many people involved in this, the Minister of State for Defense, the Chair of the Public Safety Committee, and the Public Safety Minister himself, all asked about possible amendments moving forward. As much as they keep saying, yes, we think the oversight is fine the way it is, they keep coming back to the line, well, the process is we will go to committee and we'll look at possible amendments at committee and there's a process for this. So are they straddling that line, John, just to say, we'll see how this plays out, and if the public wants it this way, we'll go to this side. If not, then we'll stick with what we had.
Yeah, and I think that could very well be how it comes out. The counter argument to that, to sort of accepting, so let's say the most reasonable and most straightforward thing, which would be have some more robust oversight of CSIS. That'd be the easiest thing. I agree with Aaron on that. The counter argument to that is that you open the floodgates then, because I think one thing that has happened in the last couple of weeks, or really even the last week, is that certain elements of the bill that really hadn't been closely scrutinized or even discussed much are out there. For example, I'm embarrassed to admit I hadn't realized that the wording of the bill included that judges can allow CSIS to explicitly violate people's Charter of Rights and Freedoms rights. The Charter of Rights has a special place in the imagination of Canadians. I wonder if it ever took hold in people's conscience, if people ever focused enough to know, hey, this bill actually explicitly envisions people's Charter rights being violated because of a closed door meeting with a judge that no one's ever going to hear about. I think people would be given pause. And I come back to a simple question I have about the bill. I've had it from the outset. I'm not sure why CSIS couldn't simply ask the police, in most cases the RCMP, to do the disruptive things that they feel they need to do or that the government feels they should be able to do under this bill. That's the key question, isn't it? Like, giving CSIS new powers to disrupt, to do stuff they're not allowed to do now, why do they need to do it themselves? Why can they not just simply talk to the police and get the police to do it when it's necessary? I think that's the system that was envisioned out of Air India and other previous looks at our relationship between security and police, or intelligence and police. I don't know why that's what's broken about that.
The civil liberties angle is interesting because I think it's very easy, that poll that you mentioned earlier, that it's very easy for people to say, well, yeah, we should do more to combat terrorism.
It's called the anti-terrorism bill. People ask, do you like the anti-terrorism bill? Yes, I do.
Do you wish that we had more rigorous, you know, would you like to be protected from terrorism? Yes, sure, okay, fine. We're going to now have, again, these weeks of committee hearings where conceivably people are going to go, well, okay, what about this civil liberty? What about this? Are we going to be locking people up for going on strike? Are we going to be locking people up for blocking a highway because they don't, you know, they're protesting something? There's going to be all these civil liberties concerns piled up. And that's where I wonder whether people start to go, oh, wait a second. Like, I really do want to be safe from terrorism, but I don't know if I trust the government and this legislation to do that in the right way. I also wonder whether at some point you run up against conservative libertarian views.
Oh, you surely will, Aaron.
And at what point does caucus, are there people in caucus who go, I don't know how I feel about all these powers that we're going to give judges and the police?
I don't know about in caucus. Can I interrupt for a second? I don't know about in caucus, but surely in the Canadian population, there are conservatives, whether large C or small C, whose natural instinct is that overarching government powers that don't seem to have logical checks and balances are a big worry. In a sense, it's more a traditional concern of conservatives than of people on the left. So I have to assume that those concerns will be voiced at some point during this debate. Sorry, Aaron.
No, not at all. I think that's right. I think this is, and this is where I wonder whether for all of the public support this bill seems to have, for all of the wisdom, I guess, that people seem to assign the political play here, to me, it feels like the Fair Elections Act all over again, where, it just, you run up against popular opinion and academic opinion, and at that point, you are in danger of looking like you're overreaching for political purposes, and that's where it becomes a problem.
What about where the Liberals are on this, though? Sorry, you've watched this more closely in the House and stuff. Do you think they have, you ask about the Tories straddling a position here, have the Liberals done a clever straddling here, or have they marginalized themselves? I can't sort it out.
They were saying, after that poll came out, well, this is exactly it. This is why we took the position we did, because Canadians want it. but they also want the oversight.
Right. Yeah, it's tough. I think Trudeau and the Liberals have taken a fair amount of criticism on this issue, and people have looked to Mulcair and said, there's a strong leader taking a strong stand. And I think the NDP is comfortable in that position. But I think the Liberals are possibly going to end up not too far offside on this bill. They want more oversight. They want changes to the bills, to the mandate that we give CSIS. They want sunset clauses and mandatory review. It's possible that the bill that ends up passing ends up coming in line with the Liberal position. And this idea that Trudeau has capitulated to the government actually kind of starts to fall away a bit.
All right. Thanks very much, guys, for your views on this. Co-host Aaron Wary, the associate editor from Maclean's, Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
Coming up on the show, we bring you a profile of German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and we try to find out if the Parliamentary Budget Officer is being stonewalled by national defense on the cost of the mission in Iraq.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, we speak with the Parliamentary Budget Officer about his troubles with the Defense Department on the cost of the mission in Iraq, and we bring you one of the most unusual excuses heard in the House of Commons. But first...
On Friday, Transport Minister Lisa Raitt announced new railway safety legislation, the latest in a series of changes since the tragedy in Lac-Mégantic. Raitt outlined the changes in a speech in the foyer of the House of Commons.
First, we want to ensure that there are sufficient funds available to compensate the victims of accidents and to pay for any cleanup that may be required. Second, we will impose mandatory minimum insurance levels on federally regulated railways in the amounts of $25 million, $100 million, $250 million, or $1 billion, depending upon the type and the volume of the dangerous goods that's being transported. The regulations would also create a supplementary compensation fund, which would be funded by crude oil shippers, to make additional resources available in the event of an accident.
47 people died in the Lac-Mégantic disaster. The opposition says these changes are a step in the right direction. Well, from the debt crisis in Greece to the violent conflict in Ukraine, one European leader has been front and center in tackling some major issues that are having impacts around the globe. That's why this week's issue of Maclean's magazine has a cover story declaring German Chancellor Angela Merkel the real leader of the free world. Merkel is unmatched in the power and sway she holds not only with Western allies, but also with antagonists like Russia.
Maclean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru flew to Germany to research Merkel's beginnings, her rise to power, and how she's handled herself as chancellor. Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaks to Michael about his profile.
All right, Mike, you're back from Germany, and I'm going to take the opportunity to ask you a few things about the cover story you've written for this week's Maclean's. But I was thinking for Canadians who've just seen her on TV now and again, have a sort of impression of her, they're going to think this is a stolid, not particularly flashy politician. Is that how she's seen in Germany? Just on sort of an image level, how do you think she's seen by Germans?
I think that's exactly how she's seen by Germans. But the interesting thing is they take enormous pride in that. They see in Merkel the qualities that they want to believe are their own. They see these reflected in her. So, yes, she is stolid. She is unflashy. She is not showy. I mean, I've heard from politicians make the point that if you sat down beside her, you wouldn't know how powerful she is. She lives in a little apartment across from a museum with no real visible security. Her husband's name is on the buzzer. And, you know, there's a police officer maybe a block away, but nobody really cares. They have this idea of her at home cooking potato soup, a frugal kind of person that looks after the household. In this case, a household is a country, and they're very, very proud of that. And I think that, ironically, perhaps makes it more acceptable to them and perhaps even to Europeans to accept her leadership.
Wow.
Because she is so unflashy and not imperial and not dominating. I think that's one of the keys to her success.
That sounds like it could be a very powerful thing if you could deploy it probably in politics. So, and again, we'll get to the issues of the day, Ukraine, Greece, all that kind of stuff. But just again on her, a bit on her background, you write a little bit about her, more than a little bit about her upbringing in the former East Germany. Why is it important that she's from that part of the now unified Germany?
It's very interesting. I mean, it's almost more interesting at times to people outside of Germany, I think, that especially in the United States, they like this idea of someone that grew up in a communist dictatorship becoming the leader of a united, free, democratic Germany. It's important to Germans as well. One of her colleagues in the CDU told me that, you know, who also grew up in East Germany.
CDU's her party, right?
Yeah, the Christian Democratic Union. So that unless you grow up in an unfree country, you don't really appreciate freedom. So there is some speculation that this has colored her view towards democracy, towards the United Europe, towards Russia, growing up in this dictatorship. But it must be said that she was not a dissident. She wasn't someone that, you know, suffered and resisted against the regime. Hmm. Now, some people have tried to, I guess, draw some blood from her on this, but it's never really worked. She joined the Free German Youth, the youth wing of the ruling party, but she was never a Stasi employee, and she was never an informer.
Stasi's the secret service, the dreaded, hated secret service of the old Eastern Germany, eh?
Exactly, and tens of thousands of Germans were compromised by the Stasi, either because they were either informers or they worked actively for them. So Merkel never did that. She was the majority who kind of got along. She did not resist the regime. When the wall came down, she famously kept her Thursday night sauna appointment. You know, she wasn't a rebel. She made the necessary compromises to work within the system. And yet, there is talk that this colored her, and this made her particularly perhaps devoted to the idea of Western-style democracy. Ironically, perhaps as well, it's because growing up in East Germany, and I spent some time with their former Russian teacher.
Yeah, that's a great part of the story.
And she was an excellent student. The teacher tells a wonderful story how some of the competitions that Merkel was in, or she was, Kasner was her last name back then, involved these staged conversations. And the teacher was very frustrated by Merkel because Merkel spoke excellent Russian. She was so shy and subdued, and she'd look at her feet, so the teacher had to really force her and explain to her that if you want to win, you know, you need to be expressive, you need to use your hands, you need to be animated. And Merkel did. She applied herself and did things that didn't come naturally to her. But the end result as well was that her Russian was and is excellent. So she and Putin now can converse in Russian. And, of course, Putin was a KGB man in Dresden. He speaks German as well. So they can talk to each other in their respective languages. And I think that is enormously important for negotiations regarding Ukraine.
Well, we might as well get on to that then, the Ukraine thing. Obviously, Merkel has staked a lot of political capital to negotiating some form of ceasefire, something to settle the situation in eastern Ukraine. First of all, why do you think she's decided to go, you know, to go all in on that issue? And secondly, do you think it's going to work, Mike? Does it look like a good strategy to you?
Well, I think we have to look at the facts on the ground, and I think those are pretty pessimistic. I mean, we had this this negotiation in Minsk, the second one, which she led, and this is very interesting as well. It was Merkel. It wasn't Barack Obama of the United States who forged this, the second deal in Minsk. But again, we have to look on the ground, and the deal was signed, and this was a glimmer of hope, as she put it. But the fighting has continued. So the actual results are not good. But she herself tried not to invest everything in it. She said it was a glimmer of hope, nothing more, nothing less.
So she hasn't, sorry to interrupt, so you don't think that she's put herself too far out on the edge in this? If it all crumbles, it's not going to be, Merkel failed. You don't think that's how it'll be seen?
I don't think so. I think if Merkel is successful, people will give her enormous credit. But I don't think she'll be blamed for failure. I think that blame will go rightly, I think it must be said, to Vladimir Putin, who wields enormous control over the rebels and over the Russian soldiers in Ukraine, of course.
Interesting. So why don't we shift to the other big issue that she's associated with, perhaps not quite so directly as the Ukraine situation, but Greece, yet another stage in the sort of rolling Euro crisis that we've had since sort of, you know, for a few years now. Where do you see, how much does it matter to Merkel how the Greece thing is settled out? Does she care whether or not they come to a deal or leave the euro? Does it matter to the German people one way or the other? How do you see that playing?
That's very interesting. I mean, a while ago, a couple of years ago, she made a decision to try to prevent a Greek exit from the euro. There was some what appeared to have been leaks a few weeks ago indicating that Germany was prepared for Greece to go. Now, that might have been a negotiating tactic. It might have been kind of a, you know, the hard bluff. I believe that Merkel quite rightly sees the danger of a Greek exit from the euro, perhaps causing a spreading, I guess, deterioration elsewhere in the eurozone. This is the block of countries that share the common currency. I also think she's emotionally invested in Europe. However, she has held a very firm line. She's pushed austerity as a strategy for dealing with Greece's sovereign debt problems. And she has the support of almost all Germans on that.
It does dovetail with that description of her image that you gave us early on here.
Well, that's just it. I mean, for Germans, they see, and again, a lot of this is stereotype. A lot of it is the kind of qualities that Germans want to believe about themselves. But they see themselves as being frugal, financially restrained people. And there are statistics that back this up. I mean, Germans, for example, don't borrow money to buy houses at nearly the levels of elsewhere in Europe. I mean, they are very prudent, and they see these qualities in their chancellor, and they want to export them. They believe that these should be these should apply to Greece as well. So there is very little sympathy for Greece. There's sympathy on, I suppose, a human level. The Germans recognize that Greeks are suffering enormously as a result of the austerity measures with sky-high unemployment, especially youth unemployment. I mean, they recognize that, but they also believe that Merkel is right in insisting on a hard line. So that might cause her some, I suppose, criticism from Greece, from Spain, perhaps from other countries in the eurozone, but it certainly doesn't hurt her at home.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with our foreign correspondent Michael Petru about his profile on German Chancellor Angela Merkel.
Coming up on the show, it's the Parliamentary Budget Officer versus the Defense Department. We talk about the difficulties arising over a report about the cost of the mission in Iraq, and we tell you why an MP's underwear caused procedural complaints and a lot of laughter in the House of Commons. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine. On Thursday, the federal government tabled its costing for the mission in Iraq. The figure came in at $122 million for the expenses that are above and beyond what the military would have normally spent if it weren't involved in this conflict. Until this week, the government had refused to release any cost estimates for the mission, and that had led to requests for the Parliamentary Budget Officer to study the numbers and come up with his own estimate.
He released the report on Tuesday, pegging the price tag for the first 6 months of the mission at somewhere between $129 and $166 million. But the report points out the Department of National Defense refused to hand over key data, which would have helped the PBO come to a more accurate estimate. In response, the department issued a statement saying it will provide the PBO with the information he needs, but only within the mandate Parliament has given him. The statement adds some of the information being requested was cabinet confidence, which means it's being discussed in cabinet and needs to be kept secret. To talk more about the difficulties, I'm joined by the Parliamentary Budget Officer, Jean-Denis Frechette. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
It's my pleasure.
Now, there is a big difference between your numbers and the government's numbers. You had a low and a high estimate, and the government has just come out with its numbers. So Canadians may be asking why the difference. What were some of the issues you had to go through in preparing your estimate?
Well, the low and the high that you can see in the report can be explained by the fact that we did not get all the information we needed, we required to do the analysis.
So how did that play out? Explain it for our listeners. What were you looking for, and why was the Department of Defense not willing to provide those numbers to you?
It's difficult sometimes to deal with, a department. Any departments, actually, when, you know, the collaboration, the interpretation of the legislation, they have such a strict interpretation of the legislation. And that is exactly what happened with DND in this case. They look at our legislation, the PBO's legislation, and they said, well, this is not part when you ask. For example, the best example is when we ask the department, for example, the number of sorties or the number of ammunition that they would use and so on. The answer was this is not part of your mandate, because your mandate is to get access to economic and financial data. And their argument was that the question that we asked was not about economic and financial data. Well, yes and no. I mean, you know, if you ask for number of ammunition that will be used, of course there's a cost to it. And for us, it's an economic data that we should have had access to.
So this is the interpretation of what is and is not economic data. And your argument is that by finding out the flying hours for planes or the number of bombs dropped, that is the price tag that comes along with it and helps you to put together the total price tag for the mission.
You're correct. I mean, economic data for us is are more than just dollar figures. You include all the factors of production, all the drivers that are explaining the cost of that the total cost of that mission. So that's really the argument that we're using. And same thing about the and there was a lot of discussion about the other reason that the department used is that this is a cabinet confidence. We don't dispute that. I mean, if they discuss that at the cabinet, we don't need the information about what or whose minister said what. I mean, what we need is if there's a hard facts and figures there, just figures, we need that figure, and I think that the figures should be made public because it's something that, will be eventually published.
So the opposition is accusing the department and the government of trying to hide the information and hide the details from those who could hold the government to account on these issues. Do you feel, as the PBO, that you're being stonewalled for information? It's not the first time you've had a run-in.
Well, stonewall. I don't think there's a general stonewalling. I mean, we have very good relationship, professional relationship with some departments. With some other departments, it's more difficult. But we are collaborating. We are discussing with those departments where it's more difficult. I'm not at that point to say that we are facing a wall where we don't have the information. Again, I mean, it's a matter of the interpretation of the legislation.
Is the accuracy of your reports not impacted by this?
A more accurate estimates of the operation, of course, because those are remain estimates. I mean, until the mission is over, I mean, you don't know how many planes they will use, how many months they will stay there. So it remains an estimate.
You talk about the interpretation of the Parliament of Canada Act and your role. So what exact legislative changes would you like to see to make sure that there's more clarification in your mandate?
It's really amending or looking at the legislation to clarify the right of access to information, and by establishing clear avenues when there are outstanding disputes. For me, it's the best approach, because it's a sustainable approach. I mean, that legislation would be clearer and provide that kind of avenues. For the moment, I don't have any kind of avenues that I can follow. I mean, the Act specifies that the PBO is entitled to free and timely access to any financial and economic data. And so I can ask, but I cannot force any departments to comply or even to use some kind of mechanism to say, well, like the OAG, the other general has a protocol with the departments clarify that situation. I don't have that. So what we're working on right now, we do have we're discussing with some departments, about what kind of relationship we can have in terms of maybe a protocol and so on. Not all of them. That's an approach that we're trying to have. But I also, and that's why I'm sending the message to my parliamentary stakeholders, as an officer of the Library of Parliament, it's my job, my responsibility to send that message to the legislators and say, well, the legislation is very good in terms of providing the information to Parliament when I have access to the information and the economic data. But when I don't have access, I think the legislation should be clarified.
So do you think that you may have to take it to the speakers, to the chief librarian, before you get to the courts? Or are the courts an option in the future?
Well, I did all. I followed exactly the recommendation of the of Justice Harrington. I did. Complain is a big word. I briefed them. You know, they are quite aware. Again, I mean, and every time that we have a situation, and this report this week is a good example. The legislation, you know, was not helpful. If the PBO legislation was not helpful to have the information, journalists use the ATIPs to get the same kind of information, and they did not get anything more than we did. A question was put on the order paper in Parliament, and even there, I mean, there was not much information coming out of it. So, I mean, that's a good example. So that's my job, is really to inform the parliamentary stakeholders, and I will continue doing it so that, you know, I'm really in their hands. The only thing I can do is my job is to report, you know, these difficulties that I'm having, and I will continue doing so. Going to court, let's take the example of this report. This report, maybe we could have gone to court and say, well, you know, we have a problem, and because I cannot go to court just for the legislation. I mean, no court will look at the legislation in general. I have to have a specific issue or specific topic like this one, you know. DND doesn't want to provide information on ammunition, for example. But as you know, going to court is very expensive. May cost, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars. I much prefer to use that money to do reports, even if they are estimates instead of, you know, real, based on real figures. But I think that these kind of reports are still more useful than anything else. So court, maybe eventually, but for the moment, it's, you know, let's see what Parliament can do.
That was Parliamentary Budget Officer Jean-Denis Frechette discussing his difficulties with the Defense Department over the cost of the mission in Iraq. And we'll end the show on a bit of a bizarre note, and we'll try to keep this brief. New Democrat MP Pat Martin created a bit of a wedge issue in the House of Commons on Thursday, all thanks to some tight underwear. During a vote, MPs are supposed to remain seated until the final tally is given by the Speaker, but during a vote this week, Martin decided to get up and walk around for a few seconds. His movements were noticed by the Deputy Speaker, who quickly scolded Martin and told him to sit down. After the vote, a Conservative complained about the inappropriate move, so Martin got up in the House and gave an unusual excuse.
I can blame it on a sale that was out down at the Hudson's Bay. They had men's underwear on for half price. I bought a bunch that was clearly too small for me, and I find it difficult to sit for any length of time, Mr. Speaker. So I apologize if it was necessary for me to leave my seat briefly, but I did not mean to forfeit my right to vote.
Well, Martin could have had his vote struck down as a punishment, but the Deputy Speaker, who was laughing pretty hard, didn't see a crack in Martin's argument and let the vote stand.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.